I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Good evening and welcome to the History of Alchemy podcast. I'm Travis Dow.
And I'm Pete Coleman from the Bohemican podcast.
To give you a proper introduction of the History of Alchemy podcast, we'll start with the history of alchemy itself. Okay, so we'll actually give you a brief rundown of the history of alchemy, and that is a good description of what this podcast will cover as a whole. Right now, we're going to ignore Indian and Chinese alchemy. But if people want to hear about that, I mean, I have some ideas that we can actually do a couple of episodes on specific Indian or Chinese alchemists or some of the philosophy. So we could do that. But what we're actually talking about is the Greek, Arabic, Persian, European, if you will, branch of alchemy, right?
Yeah, and that leads us into what the etymology of what really alchemy is. And it gives you a good rundown of where alchemy has come from and its roots in history, and where it is today as a study in itself, with its modern traditions. You know, so when we take a look at the word alchemy, we can get this from in the Wikipedia source. So we take a look at the word of alchemy. The definition in the old French, the pronunciation rather, is alchemie. Medieval Latin would be alchemia, and in Arabic would be alchemia.
Yeah, just with a hyphen.
There's a hyphen. But, yeah. Sorry. It sounds close to the ear, Travis. Actually, yeah. It's alchemia. And ancient Greek would be chemia, which sounds very close to chemistry, if you are able to kind of spell that out. Either may have been derived from the version of Egyptian named for Egypt, which was in itself based on ancient Egyptian word chemi, so which would really mean black earth or opposed to the desert or sand.
Yeah.
So, you know, it does have a history where there's a mixture referring to maybe the pharmaceutical chemistry that we know of today. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, it's still open for debate.
Yeah, no one's 100% sure. But yeah, both theories kind of make sense. Okay, so we've described the word a little bit, but so what do we mean by alchemy, right? What do we mean by the word itself? And at its most basic level, you're talking about transmutation, okay? So you're talking about changing one thing to another. Generally, what most people mean is like, you know, changing a base metal to gold. In medieval alchemy or medical alchemy, we talk about the elixir of life. So like, in the sense of transmutating a sick body to a healthy one. And then within Neoplatonism, so sometimes alchemy can have kind of a spiritual aspect. And in that sense, we're talking about the transmutation of the soul, okay? But specifically, even if they were Neoplatonists, if they were alchemists, they could have been after both. Like they could be talking about changing metals and the soul, or using kind of a mystical meditation as, you know, as a tool in their alchemy of, you know, practical alchemy of changing metals into gold or whatever. So it can mean various things and have various contexts, but basically, at the most basic level, it's changing one thing to another.
Right? When I think of alchemy, I'll give it a layman's viewpoint of this. I usually think of something medieval of changing another metal to gold, as you would hear from these fairy tales of emperors and kings trying to have their early scientists and wizards make something precious out of something that's not precious, or dabbling in the issue of occult. I mean, when we talk about alchemy, it has a kind of a wide berth of information that some people pick and choose for what they want to do with it, right?
Well, yeah, because the how is important. So how they would choose or how they would change something into gold often would just simply involve something like magic or, you know, theurgy or powers from God, powers from the above. We'll get into that in a little bit, but you could call alchemy a pseudoscience or a proto-science, if you will, but a lot of times there's a strong mythical element into it, involved. It does have a basis in science, but a science we might not recognize, like a science like Aristotle's, like four elements, or you know Plato, or you know so. Astrology versus astronomy, like in the not Copernican sense, but like the Ptolemaic sense, but still there was a system there. There was a logic to it. So if you read into it, they weren't just often total mystics that just believed whatever they want. They did have some ideas of what reality was, or you know what was real, what was not real, and what was possible. And this just happened to fit into what they thought was possible. So and
what was great about alchemy that we know of today. It's the fact there are some written records and there are some historical evidence about what we're going to be going into. And then on the flip side of that, there is some speculation because some things were lost to history. But yep. the influences of those things that were lost to history were found again maybe a generation or two later. So mm-hmm. So there is a track it, we'll try to follow historically on this throughout these podcasts to give you an idea about you know the roots of alchemy in various locations in Europe and Eurasia.
Yeah, in fact, let's jump into that a little bit. So if I were to start the history of alchemy, okay, say this time and places where it started, me personally, I would start in around the 3rd or 4th century of Alexandria. Now, it clearly goes beyond that. But if you're talking before the 3rd century Alexandria, or at least before the first century or even before that, you're mostly talking about mythology. So when I say, yeah, if we're talking brass tacks, we're talking, you know, the actual real alchemists that wrote down stuff themselves and we can go back to and we can hold those writings in our hands and read, that's 3rd century alchemy, Alexandria. But they wrote about people that were older, okay? So it clearly goes beyond that. So I want to talk about like 4th century Alexandria for a second. A lot of the episodes we do are about alchemists at that time. We talk about Hermeticism. We have an episode on Hermeticism, on Neoplatonism. We'll have one on like Jewish philosophies at the time, Gnosticism. And in Alexandria, all these, you know, including early Christianity and other belief systems, but all these kind of were in one place at one time. So it must have just been fascinating, you know, all these things kind of feeding and contrasting each other and, you know, these philosophies evolving, you know, with all these crazy influences between East and West and old and new and what have you. But this is the time and place where we get the first mentions of what we can recognize as alchemy. We did an episode on Zosimos of Panopolis. Others, for instance, he mentioned older ones, okay? But that goes into mythology, like I just mentioned. But, you know, well, to talk a little bit about what he wrote about, for instance, is we do an episode on Hermeticism and like Hermes Trismegistus. So he's often called the father of alchemy. And if you're talking about Hermes Trismegistus, you're talking about almost like Hermes, the Greek god, and he and a mixture of him and Thoth, which was an Egyptian god. And they're both like, you know, gods of knowledge, gods of wisdom, that kind of thing, but also gods of magic and the occult. And so there's definitely mythological beginnings, even, you know, like Zosimos, I mean, he was a mystic, he was a Gnostic and a Neoplatonist and all that. So it's important. It had a huge influence, but there were later, you know, this goes all the way forward to modern, what we would call science. To give you an example, Hermes Trismegistus wrote something called the Emerald Tablet. As an example, Isaac Newton translated Hermes's Emerald Tablet. So this is, you know, this brings us right up to the, 17th century?
Well, not to jump ahead too much here, but the idea of scientific methodology has a great deal to thank to alchemy, because early alchemists did this process. They did a process of hypothesis and then theory hypothesis and then trying to prove their hypothesis or disprove it. So the idea of scientific theory and thought has a foundation in this someplace, doesn't it?
Yeah, actually, I love that concept that if you want to look at the beginning of what we would call science, like, you know, empiricism, the scientific method, all that, you can see traces of it already then. So in the very beginning, you see some emphasis. Now, I don't want to paint a picture too one-sided because there's clearly the crazy, mythological, weird, murky side, and we'll get into that too. But you do see some importance given to reproducibility and writing things down so others can do it, and writing down, you know, exact recipes and being able to actually follow a process and doing something over and over, like in this case, creating gold. But the flip side was, and we get into this like in the Neoplatonist episode, is that there was a big spiritual part of it as well. Zosimos himself, while, you know, also clearly interested in metallurgy and actually doing stuff with metals, he also had some pretty kooky dreams and visions, and, you know, it's a good episode. I would recommend it. But you need to understand kind of both sides of that. But there was a logic there. I mean, I would argue that their theories were wrong and way off, but there was theories. There was, you know, what they considered science.
Well, you would see that certain scientists of the day that were understood to be at the top of their game, you can see how Isaac Newton gravitated towards this.
Oh yeah. Oh well, yeah, well, I mean, he was
do you get it? Gravitated.
Oh boy, this is going to be a long one, isn't it?
You didn't even get it at first, but now okay, you can cut that out.
I'll leave it.
That's a Red Bull talking. Sorry.
But actually, Isaac Newton, I mean, we haven't done that episode yet, but that's a really interesting one, because he did, that was a huge influence. Like, he had, I mean, he was what we would consider the, you know, the theory of gravity, and one of the inventors of calculus and all those, you know, things that we still look at today. And but he had a really deep, entrenched occult side. And you see this with alchemy a lot. So there's a lot of logic and sound theories, even if they're based off of wrong facts, which I guess aren't facts, but you know, they're based on something. They're based on the observable space, and when we talk about astrology, for instance, you can see that you know, they made a mathematical model off of things that they could observe. It wasn't just out of nothing. I mean, even the, you know, heliocentric views of the world made sense to what they saw, and the same thing goes with creating gold from copper or tin or lead. And we talk about this in, if you want to jump to that episode, like Michael Sendivogius had a very solid reasoning behind why you could turn metals into gold. And we'll do an episode on how to actually do it. Like we'll do a, like a kitchen recipe cooking.
I'm looking forward to that, because, you know, there are steps certain alchemists had written down that may not make a lot of sense to us without the code breaking, but we'll go step by step to see if we can follow these century-old recipe for making gold.
And there's several recipes, but we'll find a simpler one and go through it. So let's move on a little bit in the history. So what happened after Alexandria?
Well, you know, after the alchemists were in decline in Alexandria, some Nestorian Christians took the manuscripts to Persia. And later the Muslim conquest ended this direct Alexandrian influence in Europe. So that does kind of open the doors to the Muslim and Persian sort of contribution to alchemy. They took the idea and they expanded upon it.
Mm-hmm.
You start to get into the medical alchemy. You know, we talked about the transmutation of elements. We also talked about the spiritual transmutation that is also given. But when you look into this medical alchemy, this transmutation of the sick to the healthy, that was just as important.
Oh, yeah.
The Muslims actually believed, used the word alchemy, which is where we get it from. The Arab world expounded upon Aristotle and the Greek thinkers and their ideas of the natural world. So they really took it to a whole new level, and it was used throughout Europe.
Yeah, and we bring up Muslim alchemists or Persian Arabic alchemists all the time. Like almost in every episode, there was some influence, and before you would think, like it wasn't necessarily the Renaissance, which, you know, I tend to avoid that term, but you know, it wasn't the fall of Constantinople or the reconquest of Spain and Toledo, but much before that, we see that some of this knowledge trickled back into Europe. In fact, starting around the Crusades, but not necessarily because of them, but definitely in that time period, you start to get people in Europe reading those Greek texts again after a millennia of them being lost, but now they're mainly from Arabic translations. So a huge impact. Now, again, to kind of oversimplify and, you know, to kind of sum up the history a little bit, but we're talking about, when we talk about the Philosopher's Stone and the Elixir of Life, we're generally talking about the same thing. You could talk about, you could mention, or you could say the universal medicine, also known as like liquid gold, or many, many other names. I mean, almost in every episode, we mention, if we're talking about an alchemist, he has his own belief system of what that actually was, what it looked like, you know, what it could do, where it came from. But basically, it's all the same thing: Elixir of Life, Philosopher's Stone. It's one and the same. It's what they were after. Okay. Now, there's some interesting interpretations and misinterpretations and takes on these things, but to really oversimplify, some medieval thinkers in Europe would take these kind of spiritual meanings of the earlier Neoplatonists and Hermeticists and read them more directly, more literally. And this is a huge oversimplification. Some people might have problems with this, and that's fine. I would accept that viewpoint as well. But you see a lot of murky writings and drawings, and we'll do an episode just on some of the code and symbology, okay? So you get this strange thing where mercury doesn't always mean mercury, and you see a picture of a white man and a red lady, and there's snakes eating their tails, and just all kinds of stuff, you know, mixing it in with astrological things, Greek mythology, all kinds of weird things. And so sometimes this was code for something specific, and sometimes it was just something meant to be hidden, and sometimes it was just charlatanism, just plain and simple, you know, obscuring the truth because
they didn't
have any truth.
Yeah
exactly. Yeah. So kind of to go into this a little bit deeper, what do we mean when we say like esoteric? I mean, what are we talking about?
Well, you know, to me, esoteric gives you an idea of something that goes beyond the conservative constructs of religion or politics of culture. It's knowledge of something forbidden that's just not for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to read into. We do this podcast from Prague. This is an esoteric city. If that gives you an idea.
Sure.
You know, it's something that is off the beaten path. It has a lot of mysticism around it, and it's on the fringe. And I think that's probably a great sort of loose example for what alchemy was at a time, because it was considered from some certain viewpoints to be witchcraft or wizardry,
mm-hmm.
Or things that were against the teaching of Jewish or Christian law. So it was also incorporated by both these institutions at one point
within
or another.
Within the church. Yeah, and within Judaism.
So I don't want to give you an idea that this was completely outside the circle, but you had to kind of walk a thin line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you were going to be an alchemist, you said, okay, you know what? I'm going to be able to push the envelope with my experiments and my writings and the things that go with my learned profession. But then I'm going to have to reel it back in a little bit and say, can I put a Christian or Jewish spin on this so I don't lose my head or be set on fire? You know, because those were the punishments for people that were practicing witchcraft or wizardry.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a thin line that we see when we talk about esoteric. It's full of symbols. You know, we talk about you talked about the snakes eating their own tails and the white and red couple and Greek mythological figures. You know, the whole thing is steeped in astrology. So there is that dabbling of what many would call maybe the dark arts or, you know, white magic or, you know, a whole list of those type of things. I think that that draws a lot of people today to it because it is out there.
Yeah,
you know?
And it's the same kind of people that are maybe into astrology or kind of neo-hermetic beliefs kind of fall into this too. But, you know, we mentioned like some Christian thinkers going into this. And sometimes we mentioned a couple episodes where they would have to get, like they would be monks, and they'd have to get permission from the abbot to write some of these things. Or they would, in one case, they got permission from the Pope. Like it was banned by the abbot. And the Pope said, no, write down what you know, because, you know, we want to know, if it's knowledge, we want to know about it. And sometimes these codes, they would write in code with the understanding that you'll only be able to read it and follow the instructions if God wants you to. So it wasn't always outside of Christianity, although many times it was akin to sorcery, like there was some magical element to it. But still, generally it's pretty clear they're after the Philosopher's Stone. They mention, you know, the codes are often decipherable and sometimes not. Sometimes to this day we have no idea what they meant because it gets pretty crazy. But in a lot of times, these are alchemists are people that were leaving the books and doing their own experimentation, which is what interests us in the history of science and these things, like Albertus Magnus, Thomas Agrippa, and some of those, the Arabic alchemists that were, you know, dabbling in real medicine, and like Paracelsus that was dabbling in crazy theories that sickness isn't caused by an imbalance in your four humors, but could be an outside factor. Like, they didn't know about viruses or bacteria, but they were thinking, well, it could be caused by other things, which was unheard of. I mean, it didn't go along with Aristotle at the time. So, but if you were dabbling in nature and outside of the Bible or the Latin scholarly books at the time, and even outside of Aristotle, then you could easily get a reputation of a magician or an alchemist, even if you weren't one. And who knows what that crazy guy in the woods was doing with those plants. And so it was a double-edged sword, like you mentioned. So
I think the only way to avoid a catastrophe or losing your life at this point, if someone thought of those things of you during your studies or your scientific practices, would be who you knew and the spin you would put on it, so you can keep doing what you were doing. Mm-hmm. So if you had a connection to somebody in the church or in City Hall at the time, or a town magistrate, and then you also said, I'm doing this because I'm trying to find out the nature of God's love towards something by looking at the elements, or tracking the paths of the stars or astrological bodies in the sky, then maybe you could live a long life. Mm-hmm. So it was, you probably did have to put a spin on it. But we talk about what amazes me about this stuff, learning this from this podcast, is the things that we know today. We can actually say that a big thanks to the early alchemists. We're talking about the periodic table. We're talking about the concepts of nature, of celestial bodies and how they work. And it all kind of, laid the groundwork for other scientists in the church and outside the church, mm-hmm. to give us the science that we have today.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we see that over and over again. In fact, this goes right into kind of the Renaissance times and the fall of Constantinople, the reconquest of Spain, right? So suddenly you have this flooding of these Arabic texts coming into Europe, of the fleeing Greeks or the Spaniards suddenly having access to the Library of Toledo and those kind of things. And so you have just this flood of alchemical writings and these ancient Greek thinkers that had been lost in Europe for at least a large part of them. And you get all these new sources, the flourishing of the art, of including alchemy. Suddenly we get court alchemists, we get emperor alchemists, like our favorite Rudolf II of Habsburg, which we bring up in pretty much every show, even if it has nothing to do with
him. He was awesome.
In fact, in both podcasts, in Bohemian, we bring him up all the time.
Yeah, but we bring him up because he was a rare bird when it comes to this stuff. I mean, there weren't many emperors out there or kings or potentates that said, hey, you know what? Not only am I not going to go out and burn you at the stake or charge you with heresy, I'm going to invite you in despite what my bishops and everyone else are telling me I should do with you, and I'm going to give you what you need, mm-hmm. so that we can go down this road together. And Rudolf II did that, and he was known for that. So he basically was a magnet here in Prague to bring all these people together for good, bad, and the ugly. You said like the real scientists, the true believers, and the charlatans. They all came to Prague to see if they can get out of this really open emperor, because that just didn't happen.
And he wasn't the only one. There were a couple other princes that would ban alchemy, but then have their own court alchemists. Because there was a fear that, if you can... at one point, there was a belief that all the gold in the currency of England was alchemist's gold. So it was created from nothing.
Well, let me say this, because the difference what I'm saying here is that Rudolf II was extremely open about this.
Yeah.
The other princes you're talking he about did it on the sly.
Yeah. Well, right. Well, they were afraid of inflation. They were like, you can't just create all this gold and then, you know, then our economy collapses. But yeah, Rudolf II just allowed it. He just let it happen and it flourished. Of course, that also, and then this became a bigger and bigger concern, but this also brought along the frauds, right? Like, we'll do an episode on Gilles de Rais, who was a contemporary of Joan of Arc, in fact, you know, in the same battles.
And about he was Jean D too.
Yeah, well, right. Gilles de Rais ended up being a child murderer, and
right. You told me about him. Yeah, sketchy. Go look him up. We don't want to talk about that story.
We'll do an episode. Yeah, we'll do an episode on him.
Oh, that was,
and because he has, he kept wanting to hire alchemists, and some, you know, in his trial, they said like he was hiring black magicians and all that. But who knows? I mean, we never heard his side of the story, so that could have been over exaggerated or not true at all.
Some people say he was the first serial killer.
Right. He was definitely a serial killer. Yeah. That's fact. But he kept trying to get a way to get gold, and he kept getting taken advantage of. And, you know, there's some hilarious stories there that we'll get into on his episode. But another one is like John Dee, who actually came to Prague from Elizabeth I's court. And he invented an angelic language and made a bunch of stuff up and got really rich, then got really poor. You know, during all of this, we get new ideas of medicine. You know, like I mentioned, sickness can be cured by outside forces. We get the beginnings of pharmacy. And then there is real scientific discoveries, which we'll kind of list in a second here. But just the process itself is like you need acids, you need distilleries, you need the knowledge of minerals. You start to see these kind of markings, beginning of chemistry and real science. I would say you're early chemists with a Y, like it's chemists, but they spelled it with a Y, are my late alchemists. They're the same thing. There's not a big difference. Some are frauds and some are really following a kind of proto-scientific method and, you know, trying to get reproducibility. And we started getting into people like Roger Bacon and you know, his generation. But okay, so let's wrap up the history there, I would say, and let's get into some genuine science. So this isn't all just Hermeticism and Neoplatonism, but what did they actually do scientifically?
Well, a lot of them looked up to the stars. You know, we another part of the process requires the astrological considerations of alchemy, which is the main reason we have astronomy today. Tejo Brahe once wrote a horoscope for a prince that was about 78 pages long or so. Yeah. A lot of it committed off memory, which was interesting. Yeah. But he had the disclaimer that if the royal clocks were as much as 4 minutes off, then the star charts were wrong at the time of birth, and the horoscopes were absolutely useless.
Big disclaimer.
By the way, right? Yeah. So if you wanted to know the future, and you need to know exactly what time it is and where the stars and planets were located. Mm-hmm. You know, some 20 pages of the horoscope were just positions of the stars and planets at the time. Both Brahe and astrology at the time are things that we want to definitely go into in other future episodes.
Yeah,
sure. But you know, it's likewise you'd have to want to make the elixir of life. We talk about the philosopher's stone. Maybe some of our listeners will know the philosopher's stone from different type of things. Mm-hmm. Some popular culture issues have used the term philosopher's stone. Like for instance, Harry Potter and his stories. Yeah. You know, when you read as a kid or had read to your kids. Yeah. In my case, I'm a little older, but there's some connections with those. You can better understand your heat source, your lab equipment, the position of the stars, your minerals, and the periodic tables we discussed, and that things need to be reproducible. So it's there's a lot that goes into this, and I think that we're not just talking one particular discipline here. It's actually a huge umbrella.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, like the heat source. I know that some recipes you needed a consistent temperature for up to 10 months. So, I mean, that's a huge cost. So you need money to make money. But second, you need to have
well, Bellows, this stuff was already in existence when people were doing pottery and ceramics.
But it's precision.
Exactly.
Months at a time.
So. You could do some serious damage to the type of ceramics that you wanted to do if you had just a little fluctuation of heat. And sometimes you had to stoke those flames for days on end in a different type of kiln or cave, you know, or hollowed out part of a cave. So some of this stuff was already in place. And, you know, early scientists of alchemists decided, hey, you know what, we're going to take the ball from here and build upon that that knowledge set, right?
Yeah, I mean, sure. I think some of the things that they invented or just improved upon was just the precision of it. Like they needed these constant temperatures consistent temperatures for a very long time. But also like more concrete things like medicines, okay? Like just to give you an example, medicines that were extracted from saffron by Ibn al-Wafid of Toledo, and some chemical compounds like mercury oxide. The invention of the bain-marie, which we'll go into in a different episode, who actually invented that, and that goes back to mythology almost. But then just things like gunpowder, ink, certain dyes, paints, cosmetics, leather tannings, or at least specific parts of leather tannings, ceramics, like you mentioned, like specifically porcelain in the West. So porcelain was a Chinese thing, but they wanted it in Europe, and it was finally an alchemist that cracked the code and figured out how to do it. Phosphorus, like the invention of phosphorus, which is hilarious because some guy was distilling his own pee and for hours and hours until he finally got this glowing sustenance that he just thought was best thing ever. Glass manufacture, because when we talk about lab equipment, so you know you have glass manufacture without alchemists, but this again, this precision and this certain thickness and the advance of glass manufacture was for lab equipment for alchemy, preparation of extracts, liquors, distillation. Distillation was an alchemist invention. Hydrochloric acid, periodic tables, the very first ones at least, going beyond the four elements. Just if you think of the old Aristotelian elements of earth, air, fire, water, that can go all the way back to Babylonian mythology, but it's also found in Hinduism and Buddhism, and you can just take it from there. I mean, it's kind of a... you have similar things in Chinese mythology and their understanding of the world. But there's a lot of things to talk about and a lot of things we'll go into. To give you an overview of the show, I mean, so what do we normally talk about in these episodes?
Well, we're going to talk about history. We're going to talk about culture and how it's all connected through the guise of alchemy and the science that came from this, or the failures that came from this that we learned from as well. It's not just all the successes, it's also the failures. And I think we're going to blend that together in this show to give you a broader picture of how alchemy and its tentacles have basically come across the ages and how it affects what we do today in scientific method and what we do today in our normal lives. We can thank a lot of these early pioneers for the things that we know as basic knowledge today. So I think the listener is going to go through a wild ride here of things that they thought they knew. You know, and they're also going to be exposed to new things. And we're going to put that kind of spin on it that's going to connect a lot of these different disciplines all under the umbrella of alchemy.
Yeah. I mean, to give some examples of that, like, well, a lot of the episodes are basically, like, we don't really do biographical things, but we do talk about specific, most of the episodes are about a specific alchemist or a duo or something like this, but we still talk about their ideas of, you know, what the world consisted of or how to make gold or their spiritual beliefs. But then, like, we did a couple of episodes on Hermeticism, Neoplatonism. So any, like you said, anywhere it intersects with alchemy or if you go to historyofalchemy.com, there's a nice picture I drew because it's hard for me to explain the scope of the podcast, right? So why do we talk about astrology? Why do we talk about Neoplatonism? Why do we talk about... So there's a nice, you know, if a picture is 1,000 words, then there you go. There's a nice kind of Venn diagram that I made because we'll talk about Kabbalah at one point, numerology in general, and, things like theurgy and theosophy and, you know, their connection with alchemy. I mean, it always come back to alchemy, but, there's so many other concepts that if you really want to understand alchemy and understand where it came from and how it eventually led to science, even in medieval times, then there's other kind of things you need to understand. And so we'll talk about all of that. And I want to say one thing to the listeners, that if you are curious about something and we haven't covered it yet, or maybe we don't even know to cover it, you know, send us an idea. We'd love to hear from you. Give us feedback. Let us know what you think and what you want to hear about, because, you know, maybe it'll interest us too. So,
and a unique aspect of this is that both of us are located in probably the seat of alchemy, which is the city of Prague in the Czech Republic.
So many people we mentioned, like John Dee, Edward Kelly, Brahe, Kepler, Rudolf II.
So we're right at the epicenter of this, because you know, at the time when alchemy was really hitting its stride, it was in Prague. I would dare say it was in Prague. There were definitely some other influences around the world.
The Golden Age, though.
Golden Age. And so, you know, we're here. We actually soak that in. Driving to work, you pass places that have some strong historical reference to the early alchemists. And I think that, you know, we're able to give you that kind of exposure to a place that's very unique in the world for this type of study.
Alchemist labs still standing in Prague today. I can think of three off the top of my head.
You and I did a tour the other day of a few places near the Prague Castle, and
they're still there. So some of them still have those the symbols outside the building. In fact, the oldest house, not the oldest building, but the oldest house is an alchemist's lab, and there's still the symbols outside and the weird kind of double meanings of all those things. But we're right in the middle of it. So
is it okay to do a shameless plug for my show as well?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Well, it's a nice cross section because, you know, Travis and I also do a show called the Bohemican Podcast, which stands for Bohemian American. And it's a show about culture. It's a show about Czech lives and from the viewpoint of two American expats now living in the Czech Republic. So sometimes our shows kind of cross a little bit on occasion, you know, but we learn both from each other's shows. I think that I've learned quite a bit from the study of alchemy and how it relates to the things we do on the Bohemian Podcast, because again, it relates to a lot of it to Prague. So you know, if you can, you know, tune in. You can both get the shows on iTunes.
Yeah, if you're not sick of us from one show, you can hear our lovely voices on another.
Take it in bits and pieces. That's my advice.
basically what we do is we might change this, but we basically do one show every week. So History of Alchemy is every 2 weeks, Bohemicans every 2 weeks. We might change the format a little bit to have a shorter one in between, so there's both shows every week.
You're going to get a nice dose of both of us, folks. So
yeah,
you'll hang tight.
You'll be happy when the shows are over.
That's right, pretty much. But you're going to learn something.
Yep. So thanks a lot for listening, and I hope this gives you a pretty good idea of what we're about and what alchemy is about in general and what we'll be discussing. And thanks.
Thanks. Take care.
You've been listening to the History of Alchemy podcast with Travis Dow and Pete Coleman. For more information about this episode, other episodes, and other information about alchemy, alchemists, and related subjects, visit historyofalchemy.com. Find us on iTunes, subscribe, review, and don't forget to rate us. We'd love to hear from you. Send your comments, ideas, and corrections to podcast@historyofalchemy.com or get in touch via Facebook on the History of Alchemy podcast page or Twitter @AlchemyPodcast. Tune in to our sister podcast all about the Czech Republic, Bohemicon, which is also available on iTunes or on Bohemicon.com. Until next time on the History of Alchemy podcast, thank you for listening.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.